When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hi, Joe Devine.
John McKenzie.
Hi, Joe Devine.
And a very special guest indeed. It's The Athletic's Carl Anker.
Hello there.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. All the better for seeing you so close to that
shucks.
Microphone. So close to the microphone. You're so close. Yeah, there you go.
That's there you go. There we go.
Listen, I'm delighted to be joined by Carl today because there's so much football to discuss and also news. Yes, lots of news happened in the last few hours. So we'll try and get through all of that as well today. But the games are Ghana, South Korea, Cameroon, Serbia, Brazil, Switzerland, Portugal, Uruguay. We'll talk about all of those, as well as Iran versus the USA. Oh, Fabrizio Romano had a news story. We'll discuss that. That was a kind of odd one. Canada, some more Canada, and Cuckoo. And also, what else have we got? That's it. That's it. But if you like more stuff than I just listed off, then you should get The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. What have you enjoyed today, Seb?
Stuart James's article, Joe. So obviously the day began with a story about Andre Onana, the Cameroonian goalkeeper, and his aversion to taking goal kicks long. Our Stuart James has actually gone back through all of the goal kicks taken during the tournament's first round, first series of match days, and analysed them and described what it says about the different teams' tactical approaches. It's very interesting. Ooh. I'm glad Stu did it rather than me
or
anybody else.
Some people got too much time on their hands.
Well, he has put it to good use because it was a very interesting article.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go and read it. It's great.
Stu's always
really
good
value,
isn't he? Yeah. Carl, what have you written recently?
I did an on-whistle report in collaboration with Ahmed Wah, in collaboration with Ahmed and Phil Hay after the Brazil game. I've also been in, I can't really tell you that, but it comes out tomorrow and involves Dutch football. So you can enjoy that.
That is exciting.
That's a cliffhanger. Okay. That's even better, isn't
it?
No,
that's great. Spoilers there. Fine. And if you want to read that and more, visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where I believe you can get a deal that's £1 a month for 6 months. Oh, go and avail yourselves of that wonderful deal, which continues throughout the World Cup. Yes, exclusive to TIFO. Now, of course, I will leave you for now in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Carl Anker. Let's begin, though, with Fabrizio Romano, because Fabrizio Romano tweeted this evening that said that Agnelli and the entire Juventus board are resigning.
Yeah, that also includes Pavel Nedved. It's strange. We don't actually have any facts or any reason why this has happened, but this is hugely significant. Obviously, Juventus have been embattled throughout the season because of what's happened on the pitch. Also, financial issues at the club, questions about Max Allegri's future at Juventus. Performances haven't been very good. Mm. And Fabrizio Romano, as you say, Joe, is reporting that they are both gone. So there's going to be there's a promise of a major restructuring imminently. A new board, a new direction. Strange one. Obviously, most people know Agnelli from his role in the Super League. He's kind of like not head villain of the Super League, but he was a...
He was backup to Florentino Perez, and he spoke... The word I was going to use was eloquently, but I fundamentally disagree with what he was saying. Mm. He spoke a lot of words about why the Super League was a good idea, and he cited children's interest in Fortnite and Call of Duty as a reason for why the Super League would exist. Mm. My disagreement with that was he never quite understood that the versions of Fortnite and Call of Duty that under 20-year-olds were playing have a free-to-play model.
Yeah.
And I just believe the Super League, as he portrayed it, failed. Because he was an individual that did not understand that he was in the content business as well as the footballing business.
Mm, that's an interesting take. Well, you also had an interesting take, John, which was to say that you can't believe Allegri has out-survived the board, given how complicated the footballing matters at Juventus are right now.
Yeah, I mean, the football at Juventus has been bad this season. Like, they've crept up a little bit in the last few games before the break for the World Cup, but there was a lot of surprise that he hadn't gone earlier. Obviously, there are questions about the finances at Juventus, whether or not they can afford to get rid of Allegri. That's what the speculations are. But the whole, I think, trajectory of the last few years, maybe even the last decade or so of Juventus, has been pretty much a downward spiral in a lot of respects. And we remember the time when Antonio Conte was there. We remember the time when Allegri was there the first time. And they very much seemed on an upward trajectory, certainly in terms of the domestic leagues. But there was always this paranoia about not being able to win the Champions League. And so they went through a little bit of a soul search, and they changed things up, and they brought in a couple of more interesting managers. So they brought in Maurizio Sarri, they brought in Andrea Pirlo, and the idea was that they needed modern managers who were going to be able to bring them the Champions League. And we've talked about this in one of the videos on IRL. We did a long history of this. And they essentially lost their nerve, I think. So
It all went weird when they changed the badge to that J, which I'm a fan of. But there was definitely a phase where Juventus were a very well-run club. And then I believe they lost one of their executives who went over to Inter Milan. His name currently escapes me. And then that sort of began Inter Milan's rejuvenation and climb up, and they stopped being a year zero football club. And I've said this a couple of times on Twitter, where a lot of the time Juventus make decisions and you almost want someone from an improv class there to go, and then what?
You know what's really interesting about that is also because, like, the sort of initial era of dominance, the kind of that success that John just referenced, like, you associate with Antonio Conte, but you'll remember that the Antonio Conte who delivered that was not the Antonio Conte that we know today, not the guy that's won titles several titles in Italy, of course, but in England as well. He didn't have that reputation, so it was a little bit of a lunge. Like, it was built on, I mean, not solely, but there's some really good transfer decisions, not least Andrea Pirlo on a free transfer, Arturo Vidal coming in, like Paul Pogba, of course, was like, when you look back on that kind of thing now on Transfermarkt, you think, Paul Pogba, that's a good deal. Paul Pogba had no reputation whatsoever, really, other than being someone who was frustrated at not playing for Manchester United and Alex Ferguson. I am adjusting my mic. Thank you, Joe Devine. And so all of these good decisions sort of led to that era. And then over time, if you look back at some of the decisions now, it's exactly as Carl says. There's not an awful lot of long-term planning involved in them, I don't think.
I think it's the, and forgive me, TIFO viewer, listener, I'm going to compare things to professional wrestling. But there's often this phrase in professional wrestling that essentially become a mark for yourself, that in your rise to the top, you begin to believe your own myth and you begin to believe your own exceptionalism. And Juventus's climb came from years of running around in the wilderness. I remember 2010, where they were quite happy to just get into the Europa League and whatnot. And they made a lot of very, very good decisions in a row for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And they made these decisions because they looked for market inefficiencies and they were thinking long term. And they had a very, very good manager. And somewhere along the way, and I will probably point to one of those Champions League defeats to Barcelona or Real Madrid, they stopped making good decisions, or they stopped understanding why they make good decisions and started believing we make good decisions because we're Juventus. And any decision Juventus makes is correct. Mm-hmm. Instead of going, we need to stop thinking like the other top teams in Italy and need to outsmart them. And if you believe yourself institutionally exceptional, I don't care if you're a government, I don't care if you're a football team, I don't care if you're a university. A podcast host or a professional wrestler or indeed a podcast guest. If you start thinking, oh, well, I'm going to be fantastic because I'm me. Essentially, that exceptionalism will rot you from the inside out. Yeah. You go from a position where you start off doing a job and you work really, really hard because you want the position. And then you get to a point where you get that position and you think the position will protect you and insulate you from future bad decisions. And this is how you end up with this weird state of Juventus.
Right. Do you think
I really need to
tell me to,
I need to get out of here and make some changes.
Do you think the standard of Serie A during those years was complicit in this as well? Some of those inefficiencies? Because if you don't, like, you know, the cliche about, you need two really good goalkeepers at any club, right? And if you have one who's much, much better than the other, over time, you see a kind of a long-term decline and a complacency. I always felt it's kind of the same in football leagues. If you have one team who dominate a league and are virtually guaranteed a title to the point where they concentrate all their resources on European success, eventually, like, it's a good kind of internal scrutiny on decisions and kind of long-term strategy is the thing that suffers.
I think it's a combination of a number of factors. I definitely think there was a point where Serie A I mean, you know, there was always long-term articles of why couldn't Serie A compete in the Champions League? What does Serie A need to do to compete and whatnot? And definitely Juventus, to use the cliche, took their eye off the ball a bit. Yeah. If you look at Massimo's got a fantastic essay in Players Tribune where he describes the Champions League final against Real Madrid. And he said it was his life's ambition. He planned that final. And he describes just this incredibly mortifying feeling watching Cristiano Ronaldo go supernova in that game and just going, you can't stop that. You cannot legislate for when one of the best players in the world decides I'm going to take over. And I think the good plans and the long-term sensible planning of Juventus coming undone against superb individuals that you can't necessarily legislate for in a collective. And when that happens, you essentially, you know, go a bit supervillain. Oh, no, that effing Kryptonian, if you're Lex Luthor or whatever. Like, I need to find a way to tear him down, which is why Juventus lost their way a bit, because they went from thinking of a smart, sensible collective marketing to, should we just buy him?
Yeah.
And that accelerates a malaise. I'm not saying Ronaldo's the problem, but I'm saying the signing of Cristiano Ronaldo at that point in time probably exacerbates a number of issues that they weren't properly prepared for.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to come back to talk about Cristiano Ronaldo a little bit later. But let's begin with Ghana 3, 2 South Korea, Carl. Ghana have 3 points after 2 games. Although perhaps more interestingly, they've both scored and conceded 5 goals, which was not expected before this tournament. Well, at least Ghana weren't expected to score lots of goals. Are you happy with performances? Are you happy with results?
At full time, my heart rate was 110, according to my Fitbit.
Yes,
I checked for the 90 minutes and it spiked at 121.
Oh.
Which is, you know, that's basically when you're doing warm-ups playing a game of football. That's how stressed out I was. It was a remarkable game of football. As I did before in our TIFO group stage preview, Ghana's big problem is goal scoring and chance creation. And I had no idea Ghana would be able to score 2 goals in a game, let alone 3. Mm. I think at halftime, John sent me some fantastic little XG maps and Ghana scored 4 goals off an XG of 1.14, was it?
Yeah, to that point, I think. So the point you went 2-0 up, I think you'd scored all of the chances that you'd had in the box.
Yep.
So far in the tournament, which is not a particularly repeatable rate of return. But yeah, I think that goes towards showing just how efficient that you'd been in the box.
Yeah. And then the second half period, Tariq Lamptey starts getting doubled up on. Ghana can't really deal with the Korean press and indeed the counter press. So the first goal comes from Lamptey. He thinks he's won the ball and begins to try and play out the back. And he's immediately seized upon by two Korean attackers. The cross is, I mean, it's absolutely superb. And then Mr. Cho has a thumping, towering header to finish.
Great header, that.
It was an awesome header.
It's one of those, well, I love a header where defenders get skittled by it.
Yeah.
Like when I'm hoovering in my living room and my cats are kind of scared and scattering. It's the same principle.
Can guys imagine you doing that and going, oh, Stafford Bloor scores the winner. Hoovering your living room carpet.
I mean, we've been living together for 9 days, and that is
a very poor
impression. I loaded your dishwasher this morning.
I'm loading the dishwasher for the World Cup.
I didn't make that noise when I did it.
Well, he was pretty noisy. Anyway, fine. You also wanted to make a point, Carl, about the quality of clearances during this game, particularly from set pieces.
Yes. So Ghana have the most headed clearances in this World Cup at the moment, and I think this game has one of the records. It might be the record for this World Cup. It could be indeed a record for multiple World Cups for the amount of headed clearances in this game, because the final 25 minutes just becomes a barrage of aerial bombardments from South Korea as they really target that space that used to be held by Tariq Lamptey at right back. But then comes in Dennis Odoi, I believe. Yes, he's the second half sub. There's just so much space. Something that's quite interesting/concerning from a Ghanaian perspective is they keep conceding goals in really short succession. So they conceded 3 in the space of 5 minutes-ish against Portugal, and they conceded 2 in 3 minutes against Portugal. I think that's a case of youthful naivete. Mm. So this is the youngest squad at the World Cup, and Otto Addo is the youngest in terms of senior games or competitive games at this World Cup. And I think he hasn't quite grasp that sort of intangible nuance of game state and how you know, once you concede, you're very, once you score, you're very vulnerable. Conceding, once you concede, once you're very vulnerable conceding again. There's been a lot of, not just in this Ghana-South Korea game, but there's been quite a few group games where you see a goal has been scored and someone on one of the teams starts tapping their foreheads with a focus thing, which shows that, you know, the World Cup isn't too divorced from Sunday league tactics. Mm. Hoof it long, maximise your set pieces.
Yeah.
If there's a nippy lad, hit him with a reducer and focus after a goal. Still 0-0 lads.
Yeah. I'm just listening to the hiss in here, but I think we've all collectively fallen into a snake pit in Indiana Jones. I imagine that's... Oh, it's gone.
It's gone. It's gone. It's
we addressed it directly and it's gone. It's in which case, John, let me ask you, what did you like about what Ghana did in possession?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out just a really nice set of movements that they were doing to try and generate a little bit of space in the wide area. And the second goal in particular was interesting because it came from that wide area across into...
automatisms?
Yeah, maybe automatic. I don't know if they'd worked. They probably had worked on this because they did it quite a few times, but I'll just draw it on the board here. So we've got Iñaki Williams in the centre forward spot here. Jordan Ayew on the left-hand side. And then Mohamed Kudus coming up on the right-hand side. And then Thomas Partey is the midfielder on this side. And then we have the defence in this sort of area. And what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and generate some space in this sort of area around the fullback.
What sort of area was that?
Around the fullback.
Area. Yes, which on the left.
On the left-hand side.
Yeah, there you go.
So we've got Jordan Ayew being marked by Kim. Mm-hmm. If you call one of the South Korea defenders Kim, you're probably going to get it right. Yeah. And what we saw was like a really nice triangulated movement where Jordan Ayew would move in this direction to drag this player out of the way. Thomas Partey would move in this direction towards the fullback area, so dropping into to cover for the fullback. So then the fullback can pull forward into these sorts of areas, and so you have this nice triangular shape. So
a kind of rotating triangle.
A rotating triangle,
wing.
Yes.
Very nice.
And it just allowed them to generate space, as I've said, in this left-hand area, and that was one of the areas where they were able to generate across from. So they bought themselves a space in time to be able to do that.
And is that because when the advanced left winger sort of pulls inside and the central midfielder pulls into the left, are they taking players with them, or are they kind of causing chaos in terms of South Korea knowing who to mark when?
Yeah, so when Jordan Ayew is dropping from the left wing spot, he's pulling the left back with him. Thomas Partey is dropping into the fullback area just to give a little bit of added coverage for that area. And obviously, if Jordan Ayew is dropping into the space that Partey has just been in, then you don't need to have two players in that same space. And then the left back is moving into the space that is generated.
Sure.
So I just thought that was an interesting set of movements that shows that clearly Ghana have been working on trying to generate more chances.
Yeah, okay. Well, they did a good job of generating chances in this game. They also did a good job of defending, although it's worth saying, John, that South Korea did improve as the game went on. There's some brilliant first touches, didn't they, in those last 10 minutes?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, as the game wore on, Ghana was sitting deeper and deeper, and Carl was talking about the amount of headed clearances they were having to make. And the South Koreans were working the ball down in the left-hand side of the pitch. As Carl was saying, there's a little bit more space once Dennis Odoi came on. And those were the two areas where the crosses came in. That was the area where the two crosses came in for the two goals as well. But yeah, a lot of wide crosses for the goals. And if people were watching the BBC commentary, they may have seen the exploration they did of the defensive line that South Korea had for the first goal. So I wondered if you wanted me to just talk you through that a little
bit.
Sure,
I'd love to hear.
So the issue was that the South Koreans set their defensive line quite deep. Mm-hmm. So I've drawn the line on the board here, so sort of between the penalty spot and the 6-yard box, really quite deep. And they had a number of defenders. I'm not going to put all of them in there, but just going to show you the example. And the free kick was on the left-hand side, fairly deep, quite a long way wide. And obviously you're going to try and get the ball into this sort of area. And what happens is the ball comes in. It's not headed away properly. Drops to the floor, and then Salisu is able to pick it up and finish. And the commentary team at BBC were saying, actually, you might expect that defensive line to be much higher in this sort of instance for a number of reasons. But if you had done that, this line would have been up here. And if the ball drops on the edge of the box, it's a much less dangerous chance. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about what you will do with your defensive line in different situations. I think in this instance, because the ball's coming from a wide area, what you're usually expecting is the ball to be swung in and go along this sort of trajectory. So
a kind of outswinger in behind the line.
Yeah. And the reason that you would do that is because it maximizes your chances of hitting someone's head. Yeah. So essentially what you're doing is you're bending the ball so that it will go along the line of attackers.
Yeah.
So that if the front player misses, then there's a second and third player who might do it as well. And so as a result of that, if you are a team like South Korea who don't have the same aerial ability as their opponents, if you move your defensive line high, it just means that you're making it much less likely for them to get the ball in a dangerous area. They have to really work hard to get the ball into that, in that sort of area. Now, if it was from a more central situation, say the free kick was here. Now, obviously the wall rule applies. So that then starts affecting where your defensive line can be, because if you want to have a wall in front of the goal, then they have to be 10 yards away from the ball. So that then starts pushing the wall back as well. But again, if you think about the trajectory that the ball's coming in from a more central position, it's much harder to get the ball. You're basically aiming for one person rather than three people, as we showed on the other one. So the idea is that if you're in a wide position, you want to get the wall as high as possible so that the opposition are being forced away from the goal, so there's no danger of it just dropping into this sort of area around the edge of the 6-yard box, which proved to be so dangerous for South Korea.
McCangles there.
McCangles indeed.
With a maths lesson. I enjoy that greatly. That's very interesting. We've seen quite a lot of high defensive lines when it's come from free kicks this tournament, so always good to know why. Shall we talk, Seb, about the end of the game? South Korea really pressing Ghana for a third, probably for those last 10 minutes. The ball goes out for a corner, and it is past time.
Yep.
There'd been your standard 10 minutes added time for the 2022 World Cup. Even some would say that was short. And the referee didn't give the corner. And I sort of think, you always let the team take the corner. I mean, I don't care how far past time it is. They always get the corner. That would be my rule. I could understand why the South Korean coach was so angry that he was red carded after the final whistle.
Yeah, so this was Anthony Taylor, Premier League referee. And as you say, corner was conceded, but no time to take it. And I think if you want to avoid the kind of scenes that Anthony Taylor suffered after that game, you let the corner be taken.
Mm.
I can see it. I can understand it from both sides, because if you're the defending team and you've, I mean, goodness, they were, you know, Ghana had to defend very, very well over the last sort of 9 or 10 minutes. You think, right, well, time's up. We've defended for the allotted injury time. We have, just because it's another corner, there's no rule in football about, right, you have one last go at it just because you're in an attacking position, because then you can extend it out. You say, well, you know, we're still in the half, let's have another long ball. That's not how I think about it, but I can understand that sort of justification. Mm. But if you want an easy life, you just let it happen, I think.
I mean, okay, Carl, you're a Ghana supporter.
Yes.
I'm curious to know what you think about this. Obviously, you wanted the game to end.
Yes.
But that's a corner, right? You got to give the corner.
Can I rephrase? Because I'm interested in this. Because if that happens to my team, I think one of my grievances is time's up.
Yeah.
Time's over. My second issue is, you still have to defend it. If you then go and concede from the corner, it's still bad defending if you let it in. And so it's kind of, it's there are two sides to it.
When you ask a question like that, what I tend to do is, you know, imagine a whiteboard and you've written the sentences and you said, you've got to give the corner. And I pretend I'm a university lecturer. I just walk up with a pen and I circle got to, and I put a question mark like got to.
Yeah.
And change to. You can give a corner. Mm. Shouldn't it be can give a corner? Young
no,
man?
No, no. Got to.
And that would be my like academic philosophical thing. Yeah.
How did you feel? How do you feel in your gut about it though?
That's thoroughly in the category of seen him given. So I think when the whistle blew, it was a massive sigh of relief. Something that's quite interesting is Anthony Taylor doesn't necessarily have the best reputation in Ghana.
Right.
So some of the news going up to this game was quite angry that Anthony Taylor was the referee. Because as Seb said, Anthony Taylor is a Premier League referee, and the Premier League market in Ghana is massive. There's loads of Manchester United fans, loads of Chelsea fans, loads of Liverpool fans, loads of top six fans in Ghana. So they know Anthony Taylor, and depending on where your fandom goes in terms of the Premier League, you might have a positive or negative opinion of Anthony Taylor.
Ah.
So Anthony Taylor is known in Ghana, but between that corner decision and the decision to let the first goal go ahead, there was a VAR check for a possible handball for Andre that the VAR team and Anthony Taylor said no, the goal count. I think he's just earned himself a Some
he can now
Banco and Tilapia if he ever goes to Accra. Yeah. If the corner had been given, I would have continued to be sat on my seat with my heart rate at 120. That sure. It wasn't, I could immediately drop it by 10.
Well, for the sake of your heart, let's move on from even remembering what happened.
I just want to talk about Mohamed Kudus for a little bit.
Please do.
He's brilliant. I've said before, he's the best attacking player I've seen in a Ghana Eden shirt in a decade, perhaps since Andrade first emerged. John, when this game first started, it was a 4-3-3 initially, and it looked as if Inaki Williams would be flanked by both Ayew brothers, Jordan and Andre. But what happened quite quickly within the first 10 minutes is Andre Ayew dropped from that right wing position in what looked like to be a 4-3-3, and Kudus pushed up from the middle band to the right as a number 8 and pushed up to the right wing position. He's left footed. He can cut. He's not really a cut inside and shoot winger. He's got a really curious positional path ahead of him. So when he came through the Right to Dream Academy and reached Danish football, he was initially envisioned as a number 10 and looked to be a sort of prototypical old school number 10. Give him the ball. He's an on-ball creator and just sprays it everywhere. Gets to Ajax, is again playing as a number 10, but Ajax don't really play 10s. Ideally, they want to play a 4-3-3. If they do play a 4-2-3-1, it's a sort of staggered one, so it eventually becomes a 4-3-3. This is on Erik ten Hag. Ten Hag also has Dusan Tadic. And Kudus is experimented in as a sort of press-resistant number 8. Plays a couple of games there. It doesn't quite coalesce because he's still a teenager. And then now on the Mr. Schroeder, he's played quite a few Champions League games as the number 9. I'm not going to call him a false 9 because he's just
a number 9,
he's just
it?
Been playing as a number 9 in those Champions League games. He was asked about, do you want to be a 9? And Kudus, in his very humble, charming way, just sort of went, I'm just here to help the team. I think, depending on what club he goes to next, and forgive me for saying that about an Ajax player, but such is the way of economics in football that you can only be at Ajax for so long. I think, he was initially linked to Everton in the summer.
Came very close to going, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
Came very close there. I think, if he'd been at Everton, that would have been a really interesting midfield next to Alex Iwobi and Onana. And I think the if he gets to the correct club, he could be a very, very good press-resistant number 8 in a 4-3-3. If he gets to a middle band, so like a team that will play Europa League quarterfinals, I could see him being a number 10. But yeah. I think his ultimate ceiling is best off him being a number 8. In a Ghana shirt, I think he's going to be the on-ball creator for a very long time for him.
Okay. Right, well, there we go. Let's go for a break now. And when we come back, we've got so much more to discuss.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Right, lovely break. Iran-USA, Seb, let's charge through this now. The big game. The big game is tomorrow. However, today, an Iranian journalist asked some awkward questions at the US Men's National Team press conference.
Yeah, I'll do this quickly, just because big game got bigger and acrimony is deepening by the hour.
Big game got bigger.
Big game
I like how you build
bigger.
That.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I'm a hype man.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, over the weekend, the US Men's National Team social media channels posted an Iranian flag without its Allah symbol as a gesture of solidarity with Iranian women. Consequence of that was Iranian FA were deeply offended, complained to FIFA. And today in a press conference, Greg Berhalter apologized, said it's nothing to the team and all the coaching staff. And he's right, it's nothing to them. It's a different sort of organization within US soccer. Another Iranian journalist asked Berhalter also whether he'd asked Joe Biden to remove a naval fleet from the Persian Gulf. Also corrected Tyler Adams on his pronunciation of Iran. And then asked Tyler Adams, I've got the quote here, are you okay to be representing your country that has so much discrimination against black people in its borders? So speaking in English as a second language, so it's doesn't read that well. Obviously a really tense press conference, not your usual World Cup pre-match fare. I'm going to read you what Tyler Adams said in response, because I thought it was very, very impressive. Sure. He said, there's discrimination everywhere you go. One thing that I've learned, especially living abroad these past few years and having to fit into different cultures, is that in the US, we're continuing to make progress every single day. I grew up in a white family with an African-American heritage and background, so I was very easily able to assimilate into different cultures. Not everyone has that ease and the ability to do that. And through education, I think it's super important. Like you just educated me right now on the pronunciation of your country. So, so that's pretty impressive, pretty composed for a young guy. Young person in a pretty difficult spot there, obviously, because that attracted a lot of media coverage. But to say things are pretty tense is probably an understatement, Joe. It's, yeah, it's quite some build up to this game tomorrow.
Yeah, okay.
There is a infamous Newsweek feature of the 1998 World Cup fixture between the United States and Iran that sort of oral history, and it's fixated on the essentially what the two captains give each other during a World Cup game. And there was a long, long, long discussion going into France 98 after the history between the two nations of USA soccer going, what do we hand the Iranian captain? So if you can hunt down that article, I heartily recommend it for a snapshot US-Iranian politics from 1998. And I'm sure some media organization will write the article about what will happen when the two captains meet tomorrow as well.
Worth also plugging that our guys at The Athletic over in our American offices, they are they're doing a piece on this tomorrow morning. So can't tell you exactly what that is at the moment, but do look out for it in the morning. Mm. Maybe read it just after you do Carl's excellent piece. To be revealed.
Let's stay with the USA just for the time being, because news also emerged about Gio Reyna today.
Yeah, so another sort of non-footballing issue arose. Basically, Eric Rinaldo, the former US men's national team international, was having a conversation with an LA Times journalist on Twitter Spaces, in which he said that Greg Berhalter had lied about Gio Reyna's injury and his availability, which was a
curious thing to say.
Bold claim. He also said that there was some friction in the camp and that the players in the American side wanted Gio Reyna in the team. Seems to have rode back on that a little bit since, and Berhalter has kind of hit back, and not hit back, but sort of calmed the situation down a bit and said, that's not who I am. Said to the gathered American press corps, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, basically, you guys have dealt with me over these years. I'm sure you don't think that that's how I operate. I don't know. I have never dealt with Greg Berhalter, or I don't know anything about Eric Rinaldo beyond his footballing career, so I have no idea. But it's, again, noise. We've spoken about this a few times. Noise, distraction. It is a huge game for America tomorrow, as it is for Iran. I don't think it needed hyping any further than it has been.
Sure.
And also, yeah, it's. I just think if you try and put yourself in Gio Reyna's position, that's quite an awkward spot, I think. Like, you've got this conversation going on around your fitness, and his dad is high profile. Claudio Reyna, of course, played for Manchester City, amongst other European clubs. Very, very good player.
Yeah.
So he's in a tricky position. And hasn't played a lot of football. That was weird.
Hasn't played a lot of football.
Not football. Not football either this season for Borussia Dortmund. And so is a little bit short of match fitness. But even so, I don't think this would have been particularly helpful for him. Very weird.
Okay. Well, listen, Dylan Blue in the chat helpfully points out, and I don't know if this is wrong, so it's not my fault if it is, that there was a program on BBC Four the other night for British listeners about the previous US Iran game, which is apparently on iPlayer.
That's so very interesting. I might give that a watch.
Check that out.
Thank you to Dylan in the chat there. Fine. Let us move on to discuss Cameroon 3 Serbia, Carl. One of the best games, one of my favorite games of the tournament so far, with maybe the best new goal. Abu Bakr with a very disrespectful lob. Did you enjoy?
A lob, a scoop.
A scoop. It's a scoop.
I'm calling
it's not
a
lob.
Scoop.
It's a scoop.
It's a Baborski.
Scoop. It's one of those. It's one of those techniques you don't see often in the professional game, as well. you'd assume the ball is too heavy.
Yes.
In youth football, or if you play playground football with a sponge ball, you can get the scoop on it.
The technique as well is incredible, because when I watch the slow motion replay from the side, I could scoop like that, but only if I had like a minute to get my foot under it properly and then go. Yeah. Whereas his foot just arrives and scoops.
Gets the
no
scoop.
No stop.
Drops the defender, gets the scoop. Small conversation as to whether or not he would have gone for the scoop if there wasn't question marks.
I think he thought he was offside.
Which again, but the fact he put the ball in the net is something I really like, and something quite a few old pros have often said, even if the whistle blows, put the ball in there anyway, as practice.
The only way to make that better would have been to turn around and walk away before seeing it go in.
It's also a mildly funny goal, because Vincent has beef or aggro with Mohamed Salah. Yeah. Not that Salah's ever reciprocated or ever commented on it, but Vincent's been, I'm going to keep calling him Vincent, because normally I call him Uncle Vincent, because he's a man that, he's earned my respect.
Yeah.
He's a man that has an aura of, if he walks in the room, I'm going to stand up, because he's a serious individual and he scoops people. He said during AFCON, I don't give a toss. I don't care if people hate me for what I'm about to say, but Mohamed Salah doesn't impress me. We have the same talent. Is the only difference is that he has, he plays for, the only difference is he does it for a big club. And he's often played with that sort of chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Mohamed Salah is his, latest target of ire, but he has had a club career, and his route to professional football has had a lot of, like many African football players, had a lot of, you had to get the right bus, or you were right on the verge of dropping out, and you had to find, and it was the right time, the right person, the right thing. And he has used that as fuel for other football players who believe hasn't had that come up. I would prefer it if that beef stays in childhood pettiness and just doing that rather than clattering each other in a football field.
Yeah.
But for now, that was fun. His reputation in the Cameroon national team is also quite fun, because he's got that, what I call the aging veteran, what some people call grandpa death, in that I can't play 90 minutes, but I swear to God, whippersnapper, when I get into this football field, I'm going to play good.
Put me on for 45 and I'll scoop. Boy, did he scoop, John. Listen, there were 6 goals in this game, and I know you love goals just as much as the next me and the current me. But when there's 6 goals in a game spread so evenly, I can't help but think something's gone wrong somewhere.
Yeah, it was a funny old game, really, because obviously Cameroon got the first goal and then Serbia got a flurry of goals, two quick goals just before the half, and then another goal after the half.
A third goal.
Yeah, so we're 3-1 up, and at this point we're sort of cruising, and then went through their own sort of flurry of conceded goals in a row as well. For me, the big miss for them was Pavlovic, the left-sided centre-back in the back three, who was absolutely fantastic. He scored one of the goals on the way to getting Serbia back on track. When he came off, the goals came through his part of the pitch as well. But I did a video about the fun teams to watch before the World Cup, and I had Serbia in there. And I feel justified off the back of this game for including them in that video. But they've been quite disappointing for me in terms of the way that things have panned out for them, because they
went through... I was going to say, have they underwhelmed? I mean, because they were quite fashionable before it began.
Yeah, they had a really good qualifying period and went through a pretty dangerous run when they were getting to the tournament. And we talked about in that video the way they were playing a 3-5-2, and they were playing 2 out-and-out nines. So we've had a lot of conversations on this podcast during this tournament about the number 9 position, especially after last night when Morata comes on, Nicholas Fulcrew comes on, changed the game in different ways. There's not many teams who are playing like 2 out-and-out nines in tournament play, and Serbia definitely were. Now they've been playing Mitrovic and Vlahovic as a two. She have these the other way around usually, but for some reason Vlahovic has not been playing. He's been injured, I think, and so there's probably fitness issues there as well. And instead of having Vlahovic, then we've seen Tadic play alongside Mitrovic, and their whole team then was designed around having these wingbacks getting the ball to, particularly Filip Kostic, who plays with Vlahovic at Juventus, and just getting the ball into the box to these two. Well, with Vlahovic instead of Tadic getting the ball to them, and it just hasn't really worked for them in terms of actually progressing the ball in wide areas and getting the ball in the box to their dangerous forwards. So
Tadic has not been in great form for Ajax in this what you call Act One or Apertura of the European football calendar. There's been calls to have him dropped by Rafael van der Vaart hates everyone, but he's been on TV hating on Tadic for a little bit as well. So yeah, there's just a loss of security. They're not as secure on the ball in central areas as they used to be. Mitrovic has been nursing a foot injury since the last international break. I believe he was taking painkiller injections. Pete Rutsley, who reports on Fulham, was saying he was taking painkiller injections every single game for Fulham after that international break. I watched Fulham beat Leeds and he went down, went up for a header, went down, sort of clutched his ankle and just limped around for 35 minutes. So he's been playing through the pain barrier for a long, 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 long time. Serbia feel like one of those teams that this World Cup's arrived just at the wrong point of their calendar cycle, as it were.
Yeah.
In that if it was a summer World Cup and all these individuals were fit or had time to recorrect their form, they'd just be a lot safer than the football they're currently playing.
With Vlahovic out, then what they've done is they pushed everyone forward. So normally they played Tadic, Mitrovic as a two, and then Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, I should say, because his brother's in goal, but they played him behind in the 10 slot. And actually when Vlahovic was available, they were playing Tadic in the 10 spot and Vlahovic and Mitrovic here, and then Milinkovic-Savic as part of the two behind as well. So in many respects, I think this has come down to not being able to play the sort of setup that they were playing on the way to the tournament.
Right. Well, listen, both teams still have the opportunity to qualify, one with maybe a bit of an easier route than the other. We'll come back to that in a moment, Seb, because first I want to ask you about Andre Onana, who has left the Cameroonian team.
Yeah, a little bit of uncertainty about whether he's left permanently. That's still a little bit up in the air. There was a hope, certainly amongst the kind of the Cameroonian coaching staff, that cooler heads would prevail and that he'd decide to stay. Don't know whether that's been the case. But there's an issue over the way he plays. Andre Onana, obviously really good with the ball at his feet, likes to play out of his box, likes to distribute short. He's a footballer, basically, as well as being a goalkeeper. Rigobert Song, not a fan of that, wanted to kind of modify Onana's game. So wanted to see him distribute long, try and, maybe hit channels, go towards a target man potentially. And there's just no agreement. And Onana, there was no compromise between the two. So I don't know if that's permanent yet. Things may change overnight or tomorrow. Sure, but at the moment, not.
This is big. It's explosive. Again, I'm going to go back to Wade Tribune, because Onana wrote a really good essay before AFCON in January about how it was really important for him to make that AFCON tournament, held in Cameroon, especially after the fact he missed
drug
so much
sanction.
Football.
Yeah.
Due to his drug sanction. There's also bits in that essay where he describes his way up the footballing pyramid and how he was nudged and dismissed for one, being a football player that wants to play in that style of play, and being one, wanting to be a goalkeeper, because everyone always views goalkeepers weird. Yeah. And two, faking the stereotype of being a black goalkeeper has always been hard, because the accusation for years and years and years is black goalkeepers can't concentrate, very racially charged. And Onana comes on, and not only is he a fantastic goalkeeper, but he's also a fantastic modern goalkeeper. And he's doing it as a black man, a very proud, dark-skinned black man. So he very much is he gets this far by never changing who he is for anyone. And I think that might have, and again, please excuse me, I might be reading into this editorially and putting on a dollop of ice cream. But I think that possibly would have made a conversation with Rigobert Song, could you calm it down? A little bit more charge than it needed to be.
I was already thinking about ice cream when we were talking about scoops before, and now I'm 100% going to be upset when I get home and there's no ice cream there.
Do you think it's quite strange? Because obviously, when I think of African goalkeepers, great African goalkeepers, I think of Nkono and Bell, both Cameroonian. They had that great rivalry, and Nkono made his name at Italian 90, really, for the kind of the broader audience. And yet still, Cameroonian goalkeeper faces these challenges. It's really strange to me.
I've just watched this year, we're watching AFCON, and still the conversation was, look at how funny AFCON is, or look at the disorganization, right? There is always a certain casual AFCON viewer that watches it because they want to see something break or fall over in that sort of you've been framed thing. And Onana as well, Sebastian Haller and other players were very, very outspoken going to the AFCON tournament, going, no, this is just as important as a European Championship or indeed a World Cup. Because, I mean, I think Yaya Toure said, if you consider how hard it is for an African team to qualify for a World Cup, winning a World Cup is next to impossible, whereas winning an AFCON, because it happens every single 2 years, that is the goal as an African football player. So for a Cameroonian player to leave World Cup camp is a big deal.
Yeah.
And to leave in this manner is huge. And also, I'm just going to be really mean. One of the goals Serbia scored probably wouldn't have happened if Onana was in goal, because he probably would have kicked it properly.
I think he saves another one of them too, because I just think he's a better goalkeeper.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there's a resolution can be found there. That would be nice. I mean, Cameroon, of course, going on to face Brazil in the final game, which is a tough ask, although Brazil have already qualified, so maybe there's an opportunity there for them. Serbia, on the other hand, facing Switzerland, Seb, in a potential winner-takes-all scenario, there are other outcomes available. That's a bit of a heightened environment.
Sure is. Just before we get there, Joe, so the chat's saying that actually Onana has now been expelled from the Cameroonian camp, so that seems to be permanent now. Thank you, chat. Right, yeah, Serbia-Switzerland. I think for context...
Don't always trust the chat.
No, I think the chat's right, because there's more than one person in the chat and it seems pretty definitive.
Right.
We trust the chat.
It's the chat's fault.
Wisdom of the crowds.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
Vox Populi.
For those people that remember 2018...
The chat called you a voy boy yesterday.
A voy boy.
What's a voy boy? Because he likes to ride around on those electric scooters in Germany. They're called voys, and now he's a voy boy.
Oh, that's quite funny.
I walked myself... No, I walked myself into the abuse. It's fine. I deserved it.
I've been trying to make it stick today.
Yeah.
What do you think? Will you take it up?
I need to seem on it.
It seems discriminatory in some way, doesn't it?
It does seem like that. Yeah.
I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
Sorry, Seb.
I was going to talk about Serbia, Switzerland and what happened in 2018. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the big issue with Serbia and Switzerland is the Kosovan independence in 2008. In that game, Granit Xhaka and Sheldon Shaqiri both scored. Both of them are Kosovan. I think Granit Xhaka is also of Albanian descent. And when both players scored, they made the eagle gesture, which is referenced to the Albanian flag, which has a double-headed eagle on it. It's a nationalist symbol. And there was a lot of fallout. Mladen Krstic, who was the coach of Serbia in that game, one of the issues for the Serbians was that they were denied a penalty, which they thought should be given. And he was talking about the referee afterwards, and he said, I wouldn't give him a yellow or red card. I would send him to The Hague. Then they could put him on trial. It's tense. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that 1 million ethnic Albanians were forced from Kosovo during the war. It's a political footballing rivalry, as you'd expect. And there's a lot of, we talked about this before, there's a lot of noise. Granit Xhaka and Sheldon Shaqiri have both worn the Kosovan flag on their boots at different points. These sets of players do not like each other very much.
There was also a picture of a flag in the Serbian dressing room this World Cup, which included a picture of Serbia and included Kosovo on the landmass that was on the map as well.
So right.
It seems as though there may be thoughts on some of the players in Serbia as well. So it's going to be pretty charged, I think.
Yeah, okay. Well, a charged affair there. Cameroon, Brazil, Carl, very quickly, do you think Cameroon have a chance here, given that Brazil have already qualified?
I don't think so. Cameroon haven't won a World Cup game in quite some time now. And while their starting game is very good in the first 15 minutes, they often have this lull where they're getting hit for two goals in quick succession. Brazil have such a strong squad, perhaps up there with France as the largest strength and depth. And I think an opportunity to qualify from the group with 3 wins and 3 would be appealing to Tite. This could be one of those games where Brazil, experiment with knockout football.
Saying,
can we just hold on to the ball for 20, 30 minutes at a time and just keep an opposition arm's length, because we need to do this in the knockout stage onwards. And I think Cameroon, unfortunately, are going to be a unwitting test subject.
Okay, I'm curious to see that. Fine. Well, listen, let's go to another break now. And when we come back, we will get through two other games and two other news issues. And we're back. There we go. What a lovely break. I had a fantastic time during that break. But there's no more time for breaks now. Let's talk about Nkunku. Because Fabrizio Romano, second mention on today's podcast, he's doing well today, isn't he? Fabrizio Romano announced earlier that Nkunku to Chelsea is nearing completion, John. What do you think about Nkunku?
This is the first I've heard of it.
Well,
which is exciting.
Let's get John McKenzie's live reaction.
Yeah, very interesting. I think there's been talk of this for a little while, right?
There has, so it's not really a live reaction.
And anyone who watches the Bundesliga knows that Christopher Nkunku is a real talent, and he has been, particularly I think last season was excellent. Essentially carried them to the DFB Pokal, the domestic cup in Germany. Obviously he's been good this season as well, but really exciting talent who is able to create goals out of very low chances, and the ability to do that, it's a very banal point to make, but the ability to do that at the highest level is sought after, and that's why Chelsea are very keen on getting him into the team. And I think a really important player, type of player for Chelsea to get into their squad as well, because I feel as though that's almost what they're lacking at the moment. We've talked a lot about Graham Potter and what he's trying to do at Chelsea, but we've also talked about how the squad is sort of very clunky, and there's not really anyone there for them who can be that creative player in the way that you might want. And I think Christopher Nkunku will be good.
Oh, very. Well, I'm excited to see that happen if it does. Carl, would you like to add some analysis there? You looked as though you wanted to.
I've just got this. With Chelsea. Again, they need an improv person. The room go, and then what?
Yeah.
I think Grace Robinson, fantastic tweet, and got a great newsletter and subtext that you should all subscribe to.
Grace on Football.
Yes.
Yeah.
Opined that this is one of those sort of transfer deals where Chelsea went, oh, it's a good player in the market. Just get him in and we'll figure out later.
Yeah, right.
I think. Yeah.
It doesn't work unless there's a number nine coming through the door at some other point as well, with somebody who can play that role better than the players they have on their books at the moment. Like, Nkunku needs something. Nkunku needs a reference point.
Yeah.
Like, that's always been my feeling at Leipzig. Different team, different setup, different standing in the game in Germany to what Chelsea are in England, yeah. But he works best when there are other focal points. He's super player. Really, I like it. Also, what's exciting about him, I think, over the last 2 years is his development has been so quick and so dramatic. And you're still not quite sure what his peak is. And it's always such a fun time of a player's career to watch. He's really, really good, but needs other pieces around him.
Well, we look forward to seeing him more if that does occur. Brazil, let's talk about Brazil. 1-0 Switzerland. Qualified with two wins, John. Neymar didn't play today due to injury. Firstly, what impact did that have on this game? And what impact does that have on Brazil going forwards if he misses more? We're unsure so far.
I think one of the biggest problems that you can face as a good side in the international game is what happens when you inevitably come up against a side who are going to defend well, maybe defend in a lower block, have a very structured defensive setup. And Neymar is basically the cheat code for that, because his ability to move the ball around to dribble defenders in central spaces, not just in wide areas where there's a bit more space, but in the center, pull defensive structures around and generate space for his teammates is really important. And obviously he wins a lot of free kicks as well, which can help in those situations too.
He's a game changer who changes games.
That's right.
Yeah.
I listened to the podcast the other day, heard that. That's a good line.
Oh, was that not you here?
I wasn't in for that one, last time? I don't think.
You call him a playmaker. That's a playmaker. He made the plays.
There you go. Carl's picking up what I'm putting down. Please continue.
So, in terms of what happened you've completely thrown me. But
Michael Irvin quotes will do that.
Yeah. See, this is what happens. I'm in full flow.
Yeah.
And then you I'm just, sorry,
you,
John.
But nothing. You do. Yeah. You do. No, but you were saying about Neymar as being a cheat code for a low block. And, of course, Switzerland, very difficult team to come up against if you need to score a goal.
Yeah, and the Swiss have always been very solid in these sorts of situations. Now, Neymar was replaced by Paquetá in the sort of number eight slot where Neymar's been playing. Now, Paquetá is a creative player. He's more creative through passing than he is through dribbling. So the big question is, how's that going to change the game? And Paquetá was brought off at halftime for Rodrigo, who plays for Real Madrid. Also plays with Vinicius Junior, who was on that side. So it may have been that Chiche thought that there was going to be more dynamics between
them. Just ignoring Fred.
Fred's on the other side. It's all right.
Poor Fred.
Poor Fred.
Fred
was the direct group in terms of the body that came in for Neymar. It was Fred, but you are absolutely correct.
I'm talking about just the roles.
Yeah, in terms of the role, it is. Sorry, Paqueta, which I didn't. I was saying Paqueta.
So. Well, I was saying Paqueta too, but we discovered it's Paqueta.
It's Paqueta. I think it's the emphasis on the syllable. I think we're getting wrong.
Oh, but I see.
It's the syllable emphasis.
I'm sure someone will. We've also spelled his name wrong on the board. I know we've spelled it right this time around. So that's good.
Well done, well us.
Nice little victory.
Yes, good. Sorry. Again, I've cut you off from your flow. I'm very, very sorry. Please continue to cook. Continue to cook, my man.
Yeah. So in the event, we obviously saw a fairly lowish block from Switzerland. They end up dropping the wingers in and they're playing 4-2-3-1, but they end up looking like a 4-4-2 block. And then the big question then is how you're going to break that down with these sorts of players. Both Rafinha and Vinicius Junior, I think, are very aggressive dribblers. They're very much raw dribblers in the sense that they are going to blitz past opponent fullbacks when there's space for them to run into. So again, you're probably losing a little bit from those two if you're playing against a team who are going to be sitting deeper. And we talked about Richarlison a lot in the last fixture as well, because there's big questions about whether or not they should have gone for someone like Gabriel Jesus for precisely the reason we're talking about, because he is again another a creative player who can is also very good at dribbling, moving the ball in tight spaces as well, which can help as well.
People said I was stupid for suggesting that last time we talked about them.
People will call you stupid no matter what you say, because people want to be in your position.
They do you think?
Just drag you down. That's how they. That's what my mama tells me when people are mean to me.
Huh?
And also, just saying one thing that is true doesn't make you not stupid. I think it's important to remember that.
Oh.
He's encouraging you. Thank you, John. That's really useful.
Carl, this isn't a positive place that you've walked into this evening. We no.
Look,
we don't do any of that.
My national team won today, so I'm bringing some positive.
Yeah.
Hold tight, the 3-point collectors.
Yeah. Well, John, I mean, I don't know if you were finished or not, but you cooked up something real sweet there. You finished? Am I eating too early?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit. I don't know if this is on the running order, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how what's interesting about Brazil is that they play with a very European style.
That is on the running order.
I put it on the running order.
You mentioned that during the game.
Yeah.
And I was curious to know, you said mid-game that Chiche is tactically a bit European in style. Mm. I think I know what you mean by that, because I listened to an excellent podcast where you talked about this very thing. But please tell listeners and also tell them where they can listen to that if they haven't.
So that was a podcast on the TIFO Talks podcast, which is on the TIFO Football podcast channel. So if anyone subscribed to that, you will get it. It was with me and with Jamie Hamilton, and we were talking about the very European approach to football tactics, which is very cerebral, thinking about things in terms of structures, formations, and one of the big things that we talk about a lot on this channel is the fact that a lot of European managers will use what we call positional play. Mm-hmm. And that the idea behind positional play, I always draw these lines on the board. So penalty box to penalty box and then D to D. So you have a wide space, a half space, a central space here, and then another half space and wide space here. And the general idea then is that if you have opponent centre backs on the lines here, you are then generating these channels which can be exploited space wise. And so a lot of European coaches in possession will try and hold the ball, build the ball up, move it through the thirds, and then get it to players in these channels. So you'll often see the striker in the central channel, then the two wide players sitting very wide and pulling this back line apart. So we've got the back four here, and they're spread as far apart as you possibly can. Again, that creates space in between the centre backs and the full backs for the number eights in this instance to attack. And it's all about getting your players in the right structures, making sure that they're occupying the right spaces and being able to exploit it in that way. Now that's something that a lot of Brazilian coaches won't necessarily be trying to do. There's a coach at the moment in Fluminense called Fernando Diniz, and he is I don't want to say pioneering, because I think it's an old style of play that they used in Brazil, but very much based on
he's an exemplar.
Yeah, futsal, and this idea then is getting lots of players around the ball when you have possession, which is very different to this positional play, which is making sure you're spreading out, you're getting good spacing, you're getting all the channels occupied at various situations.
Something that's really important to Chiche, am I saying that correctly? Yeah. Is he went on a European pilgrimage before the 2018 World Cup.
Oh.
He, I believe, basically just before he begins his process with the Brazilian national team, when Brazil football needs to change and update itself, goes to Europe, spends a lot of time with Carlo Ancelotti, I believe, spends a lot of time in Italy, spends a lot of time in Spain, and he basically just tries to learn as much European club football he can bring back home to Brazil and not only help the top national team, but hopefully trickle down to other levels as well. This is one of the big things that sort of marked him out as trying to do Brazilian football differently. It earned him some raised eyebrows and a lot of credit in the bank going into that 2018 World Cup, and made a lot of Brazilian football fans believe that that was going to be their World Cup. Mm. It also caused a quite interesting immediate reaction after they lost to Belgium, where at least one Brazilian football fan went to me, well, is Roberto Martinez a genius? Because he beat the person we believe is a genius. Mm. So what happened there? But yes, Chiche is a really interesting thinker in football, and he's been really almost like a holistic approach.
He's very, very popular with his players. Mm-hmm. Like if you hear the accounts of kind of squad life from Brazilian players, Brazilian internationals, he's as popular as a Brazilian coach has been in like decades. Which seems super important given the amount of egos and talent, and given sort of how you can have players like Gabriel Jesus sitting on the bench. That matters, because you've got to have someone that, from a player's perspective, you respect, you admire, and they seem to have that. And it's an essential ingredient for a stacked squad, I think.
I would say interesting that Carl brought up Carlo Ancelotti, because I believe he comes up in that podcast that you referenced with yourself and Jimmy Hamilton as potentially the most South American of European coaches, which is an interesting. If you haven't listened, have a listen. It's one of the best podcasts I've listened to in a really, really long time. John's chat with Jamie Hamilton. It's on the TIFO podcast.
It's great.
Feed.
It really is.
Yeah, you can go find that.
Yeah, John can't say that.
I would
really
love to spend more time talking about it, but unfortunately.
Can I just conclude? Because
what I was
going to say was simply that this is a very structured way of playing. A lot of Brazilians are brought up playing a much less structured way of playing and playing futsal and stuff. And that's where a lot of the stylistic ideas that you see and think of when you think of Brazilian football come from. So I think the obvious question to then ask is, if you're trying to overly structure the way that these Brazilians playing, are you actually removing something of their upside? Mm. And again, I think this will be a question that is raised if Brazil don't go all the way. Is this just too European a way of playing football? Should Brazil be returning to this more, I guess, flamboyant, but also more, it's less spatially concerned. It's more about getting players around the ball, playing really quick 1-2 passes through the field and generate chances in that way. So I think that's kind of interesting question that will be raised as the World Cup goes on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about that a little bit more when we have more time next time. Yeah. Okay. Canada. What happened with Canada's goalkeeper, quickly, Seb?
Nothing good. So in last night's game...
You're the bad news guy today.
I really am. I'm delivering poor news all the way through the podcast. Yeah. So there was a flag displayed by the Croatian fans aimed at Milan Borjan, the Canadian goalkeeper, who is of Serbian ethnicity. He fled his town in the Croatian War of Independence. And the Croatian fans behind his goal displayed a flag which said, nothing runs like Milan Borjan, which is a reference to him fleeing. And it was made up on a kind of a John Deere tractor flag, they're sort of the advertising slogans. Mm. And that's a not very subtle reference to the fact that when they fled those towns, the Serbs fled in convoys which included tractors. Yeah. So hence the John Deere reference. Right. Also, rather unfortunately, his mobile telephone number was leaked online, and he's received thousands of threats. And not quite sure where that story is ending. It's developing, but not good.
Well, I speak for all of us when we say we hope he's okay. The Canadian goalkeeper, Borja.
He plays for Red Star Belgrade, so let's hope that has a good ending and everyone sort of settles down.
Yes, well, wishes all the best wishes. Portugal 2, Uruguay 0. Carl Anka, Portugal top of the group, 6 points. They have qualified, despite looking a little uncertain. The only thing I remember about this game was that Ronaldo's goal wasn't his goal.
No, this is a... This is a strange Portugal team right now, because Fernando Santos.
Yeah.
For half a second, I want to call him Frederico. Yeah. Fernando Santos is a softball exemplar. Him, Deschamps, are the reasons why England play soccer ball, because Southgate went, ooh, they are savvy and experienced. That's what he used there. Yeah. And the entire way Portugal won the 2016 Euros and the Nations League is...
winners.
Yep. They score a goal early, they control the space, and as far as Santos is concerned, a 1-0 victory is just as useful to him as a 4-3 victory, so why don't you just get the 1-0 victory and just spot the space, control, maximise your set pieces. Against Ghana, they were just really open and porous in central midfield, which certainly shouldn't be happening when you've got midfield talents of Portugal's squad. And they just, that their front three, the combinations of their front three and front four doesn't seem to be working right now in that Bruno Fernandes, Cristiano Ronaldo, João Félix, and when Bernardo Silva was higher up, they're all players that benefit when they play with a constant penalty box operator, play with a person who predominantly wants to stand on the last line of the centre-backs. Strangely enough, this Portugal team would be better if Edinson Cavani was playing for Portugal. Yeah. It's the simplest way I can explain that.
That's a good point.
For the goal that was initially awarded to Cristiano Ronaldo, but now seems to have been given to Bruno Fernandes because the hair connection wasn't quite deep enough. It starts off with Ronaldo getting the ball deep on the right-hand side, and I believe we were watching together, and I sort of just yelled at him, what are you doing there? Which is something that I've yelled at Cristiano Ronaldo more than once this season. Ronaldo's affinity to the ball and want to always be around the ball means he often vacates central attacking spaces and creates situations where Ronaldo is in wide positions delivering crosses that he himself should be on the end of, because Ronaldo wants to be on the ball. There's this old quote about how certain passes you make, not because it's useful, but you just simply want to keep your striker awake. And I think Ronaldo has that sort of license in this Portugal team where he just does certain things because he wants to be awake and feel involved. But that was how the move starts. And eventually he does take up that position on the last line of Uruguay's defense. So when the cross comes in, he's well placed for it. And the cross, he's delivered either too quickly or too sharply, and then it goes in anyway.
Sure.
That's the sort of thing that's meant to happen. And then Portugal was supposed to just shut up shop, close the space, and just be quiet.
They got themselves a nice penalty.
And then what they did was they introduced Mr. Leo, who, I mean, he's loads of fun and probably should be starting and will definitely be a starter come the Euros in 2024 when a striker comes in for whoever succeeds Cristiano Ronaldo. Maybe if Cristiano wants to play in 24, then okay.
Sure.
And then when Real came on, Portugal got more fun. But also, again, that's not the point of Santos ball. Portugal aren't meant to be fun.
What are they doing, huh?
It's weird in that they're not playing the way I expect Portugal to play, which is more entertaining for the viewer, asterisk, question mark, maybe? But leaves them just way, 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 way more open to the opposition to pick things up. I have no idea what's going on.
Someone's moving furniture around.
It is 20 past 10 at night. That's a strange old time.
That's a bin, isn't it? That's an empty wheelie bin.
Is that a bin?
I mean, we're quite a long way from...
What do you think, Jamie? A car?
Ooh.
What a car sounds like that, hey? That's a bad car.
That needs an MOT.
Okay, well, anyway.
Portugal more fun, but it always leads to these 15 to 20 minute periods where the opposition can go, oh, look, your midfield is vulnerable. I'm going to just progress up the field, which is, I mean, John, that's what happened for a good chunk of the second half, wasn't it? Uruguay just kept going.
Yeah, Leao was brought on for Ruben Neves, and then João Félix was dropped back into midfield, which it seems weird for someone like Santos to be so concerned about solidity to then drop someone like Felix into his midfield, but realized fairly quickly that wasn't going to work, and then brought on Nunes and Paulinho as well to just solid things up a little bit. But yeah, Rafael Leao having a great season at Milan, having had a great few seasons at Milan, but again, another one of these players who is if you're wanting to play in a very specifically defensively solid way, yes, he's going to give you a huge upside going forward. And that's why everyone wants to see him play, because he's just incredible at what he does. But in terms of if you're wanting to keep a game tighter, it can raise some sort of questions as to how much space he's going to give on that side as well. So
Let me ask you, Uruguay haven't scored yet. I mean, they can still technically qualify if they beat Ghana and South Korea lose to Portugal, which is a possibility. Carl Anker taking a deep breath there. What do you think, John?
I think that Uruguay have been really quite conservative as well. I mean, Carl called it sufferable before, but I think the problem with Uruguay in this game was that they just sort of sat back until the goal, and then they sort of went for it a little bit more and didn't quite have enough to actually manage it. But again, we've talked a little bit during this World Cup about whether or not that approach is actually working out as well as it has done in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I always remember what Rafa said to me after the Euro final.
That sounds like the beginning of a song.
Rafa said, Rafa said on Totally Football after the Euro final, sort of really sad in the cave of Wembley. And he said, England cannot win a title playing a tribute act to Portugal and France, because Portugal and France still exist out there, and Portugal and France are beginning to implement more club football tactics. And Italy beat England because they, out of all the European clubs in the Euros, were the one that most successful were implementing club football tactics, their set pieces and their positional play. And I think this World Cup is beginning to see a number of nations caught in between suffer ball and progressive play, positional play and whatnot. So you're seeing these teams that you've known from the last World Cup, you've known from the Euros or the last Copa America or the Copa America before that, and you go, that's Uruguay. They play Oscar ball. They play in a certain way, and they go, Oscar's not there anymore. Are they trying to build through the thirds? They don't normally do that. They've got a couple of young players who will be really good in 2 years and a couple of players who can't run anymore.
Yeah.
And if this World Cup had happened in the summer or whatnot, they might have had an extra little bit of a zip in it. So this Portugal team isn't playing like the Portugal I normally know. This Uruguay team isn't playing like the Uruguay team I normally know. I have no idea what this Ghana team is. This England team, well, I'm assuming they're going to play 3-4-3 at some point, but Gareth Southgate might just continue playing 4-3-3. I think the calendar's getting you tripped up just as well as the tactics and your opponent. And that's the big thing I'm getting watching both of these two teams, in that I can see the type of football they want to play in 2024. And I can see why that'd be really good. Watching the early genesis of it is weird. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. But there is no more time.
Joe, there's a quick thing that I'm going to address from the chat.
It better be important.
It is important.
Seb loves the chat today.
I know. People are talking about the penalty.
What are the chat says?
Yes. So yes, everyone's saying not a penalty. And it is an important thing to say, because the IFAB guidance on this is
you said it was important.
It
IFAB
is important.
Guidance.
It is important. IFAB guidance. The literal rule book.
This is, as Carl says, this is literally the rules.
Uh-huh.
It is not handball if a defender is supporting himself with his hand on the floor and the ball hits
falling.
His foot. Exactly that. So he's putting his hand down to break his fall, to support himself, and the ball hits it. That is not a penalty. It should not be given.
According to the IFAB rule book.
Yeah. The people who write the rules say that is not a penalty.
It's kind of enraging to see
it happen in a World Cup.
The game.
No excuse for it being given.
Sure.
It's farcical.
Seb IFAB Boar now.
Yeah.
I found it absolutely farcical. I got really raging and I looked down and realized I was wearing a Ghana kit.
He's got.
Why am I raging about an injustice that's happened to my big World Cup rival?
It's good to rage.
It was quite cute to watch all the Portuguese players just sort of stand in a circle around the penalty spot. It's like, no, we won't let it get scuffed up.
You also got called Seb Hoover Floor earlier, which worked quite nicely, isn't it?
That's good.
Yep. Anyway, listen, everybody, put your headphones on just for 15 seconds and enjoy yourself, because producer Don is going to play a nice song for us now, aren't you, producer Don? Here we go. John, dance
on beat.
Okay, here we go. We all enjoyed that.
I did indeed.
We throw our headphones on the floor. Now, Carl, you're going to have to listen to me now as I talk about a lot of scores that don't relate to you, but you can celebrate with me, because today
I'm
the winner of the day.
Oh,
points are so bad. You guys got so many points. Why did you get them? I've told you, they're bad.
Rooney! Yeah?
There he goes. Okay, I got 10 points today. That's the best, by the way. 10, not a good day. Will come. Oh, no, that's right. JJ did okay, 11 points. You guys are sharing 12 points, so you've allowed that gap to grow there.
Hey, that's a pretty close day. I mean, everyone's done badly, but it's still pretty close.
I won. That's all that matters.
You won.
You have allowed
doing badly.
The gap, not specifically
less
you,
badly.
But he has allowed the gap between first and second to grow by one further point. Yeah. It needs to shrink. Okay. There's a lot to talk about here. But anyway, listen, that means that I go last today. John and Seb, you go first. But intriguingly, we have a first time occurrence here. Now, normally what would happen when you share points on the day is that the person who's leading between the two goes
first. We're
level,
aren't we?
But you were also level in the grand total. And so I'm going to give it to Seb because he needs all the help he can get. And when you go first, John, you seem to make mistakes. So, Seb, let us begin with Netherlands-Qatar, please.
I will say 4-0 Netherlands.
You think 4-0 Netherlands. Yeah. Okay, John, what do you reckon?
3-0 Netherlands.
You're going for 3-0 Netherlands. Okay. That was JJ's first request, but his second is a 2-1 to the Netherlands. And I think this is going to be a 1-1. I think the Netherlands have already qualified. I think Qatar are going to want to go out strong. It's their final game. It's their final opportunity. They can't qualify, but there's no reason they can't put a big performance in.
You're
in front
do
of their
this
home
with
crowd.
Every result.
What? Just talk
you're
a bit more.
Explain to why you think it is. After cutting us off in the middle of a very interesting conversation, you're now going to explain your predictions in great detail.
Next game is Ecuador-Senegal, sir.
2-1 Ecuador.
2-1.
I like Ecuador. I really like Ecuador. Really like Ecuador.
I think we're going to hear something similar from John.
Yeah, I mean, I said that Ecuador would beat Senegal in the first podcast we did in this
World Cup want the ooh to apply to you? Carl, would you do the ooh again for John? He's feeling left out.
Ooh!
Well, I said that and then everyone got at me and was like, oh, this is ridiculous.
So please repeat.
I said in the first podcast of this World Cup that Ecuador would beat Senegal.
Ooh! Spicy.
Yeah.
Are you going to say that again?
I'm going to have to do that, yeah. But,
In which way are you going to say that?
I'll say 2-0.
And are you going to say every time you have a score that you have to
say? I just said 2-0, didn't I?
JJ,
I've got to say that bit.
JJ's asked for 1-2. He thinks Senegal are going to win this game. So he's gone for 1-2. And I have no idea. This is a winner-takes-all situation,
is.
Though, isn't it?
It
right.
Is.
So
Senegal
one team does need the win.
Yeah, Senegal needs the win more than Ecuador do.
I'm going to say 1-3. No, that's stupid.
No one ever... 3-1s don't exist.
3-1s don't exist.
That's my weird quirk.
What should I say?
You can predict.
Why don't you talk us through it? All the so good, we know exactly
you
what
can predict
the
draw. Yeah. That is
John
allowed.
John is so salty tonight.
He's rattled you, hasn't he?
Seb brought these delicious cookies into the office earlier and they were covered in salt. And I wonder if John got one of the salty ones because he has been salting all over the place.
I made sure to avoid the salt.
You've been shaking that salt in my direction. Now listen, I'm going to say Ecuador, Senegal. I'm so confused. I'm going to say 2-0.
You panicked.
I panicked and said 2-0.
Did I say 2-0?
I meant to Senegal. I'm going to go 0-2.
Before you all do this, did any of you check on Ana Valencia's injury status?
No. Absolutely not. We don't do things like that for points
Carl,
are bad.
This isn't a serious
we don't care
game.
About facts.
Availability
except
and
JJ's at home checking on the status because he's playing it sensibly.
I'm nervous. I'm just saying.
Seb, Steph, oh no, it's me. It's who goes first? Seb goes first.
Which game do you want first?
I want Wales, England, please.
2-0 England.
2-0-2. Okay.
Wales are very confident.
John.
3-0 England.
0-3. Okay. JJ Bull has
got
gone
5-0 Wales.
No, he's gone 1-1.
Okay.
Which is, to be honest, is what I was going to go for because I think Wales are going to come out strong tomorrow. And I will explain myself.
This is the champion's advantage. He gets to explain himself.
I get to explain myself.
Apparently, there's more space in the podcast. That's incredible. The time limit has just been extended. Incredible.
He's mugged you off here.
He's found some extra time down the back of the sofa.
Yes,
there it is. Scrabbling around.
Listen, you guys are eating into my extra time. This is my starring moment. 5-0, obviously. Iran, USA, please, sir.
Have you done JJ?
Oh, no. Yeah, JJ got 1-1. Okay. He asked for 1-1. He comes third. I'm the winner.
I think Iran, USA, 1-1.
You think it's a 1-1?
Yeah.
Okay, and what does that mean for the group if it's a 1-1?
That would put Iran through.
Yep.
That would put Iran through. Yep. Okay, John.
I'm going to do 1-0 Iran.
Oh, wow. Ooh. Okay. JJ Bull has asked for a 2-1 Iran. I'm going with the Americans on this one.
Okay.
I'm going to say it's a 1-4. Oh.
That's wrong, isn't it? I've said it now. I've locked it in. I've locked it in.
In your Excel sheet, which cannot be changed.
Right? Well, yeah,
it would be impossible to.
I could change it, but it would be against the spirit of the game.
I agree with you. The spirit should be there. Like,
you're just saying that because you're so far behind, JJ. And let me tell you, John, I know you,
podcast, I have to say,
air quotes, don't care about the game. And
I didn't say I didn't care about
the game. No. What I'm saying is I know you don't think the game says anything about you and your ability to understand football. And I'm not saying that it does either. Some people might think that it does, but I'm not saying that. Other people might be thinking that and saying
many
that.
Many people are saying this.
But it's not me that's saying it. But if I was to say it, I would infer something from the current state of affairs. Okay. And that is that whilst I'm last, as I should be, the man who finds extra time, you are now sharing second place. Oh, you're still sharing second. You shared second place yesterday. Yeah. You're still sharing neck second place with Seb on 75 points.
Very Trumpian delivery, this monologue.
I'm trying it out. I'm trying to get a little fierceness behind me. You know?
Affecting a wrestling heel character here.
I'm trying to confuse, you know? And it's a very, very big deal. And you won't believe what score JJ has. It's an incredible score. You wouldn't believe it. He has the score of 65. He's now 10 points ahead of you. And that's what they said. Who's they? I don't know. That's how it works. Okay, that's the end of the game there. And indeed, the podcast. Carl Anker, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
What a charming guy. John McKenzie, thank you for your sass.
You're welcome.
Yes, I am welcome. Seb Savablore, thanks for attending.
Thank you, Joe.
And thanks, as usual, in the producer's box over there, we've got Jamie and Don. A big thank you to them. Yes, we'll be back tomorrow with JJ Ball and more as we discuss all of the big games. Until then, take care, goodbye.
Stay hydrated.
Sleep good. Well.